The following is a featured essay by Kim Monson Newsroom, published on The Kim Monson Show. The opinions expressed are those of the author and do not necessarily reflect the views of The Kim Monson Show. The King Who Became Musket Balls. On July 9, 1776, a gilded George III came down on Broadway, in a Connecticut orchard. His 2 tons of lead were recast as some 42,000 cartridges for the Continental Army. The distance between those two facts is the meaning of independence. In the autumn of 1776, in a shed in the orchard behind Oliver Wolcott's house in Litchfield, Connecticut, a king was coming apart in the heat. The lead had been a horse and a rider once, gilded bright above New York Harbor. Now it lay in carded fragments beside a fire, a flank here, a fold of a Roman cloak there, softening, slumping, running to dull silver. Wolcott's daughters and the women of the town worked the molds in shifts, ladling the molten metal, tapping out the cooled balls, rolling them into cartridges, and by the family's reckoning, the tally, when it was done, came to 42,088. Each pound of the king yielded about 20 rounds. The gold leaf had been stripped off first and carried away. What went into the molds was the plain gray weight underneath, the part that had been made to stand still and be looked up at, now made to move and be fired. 2 tons of obedience, dismounted, hauled up into the Connecticut hills, and handed back to the Continental Army, a musket ball at a time. This is where the meaning of independence becomes legible, in the passage of one object from Bowling Green to that orchard. For 6 years, the statue had told New Yorkers a story about themselves, that they were subjects, that authority came down from a man on a horse, that gratitude was the proper civic feeling. On the night of July 9, 1776, hours after the declaration was read aloud to General Washington's assembled brigades, a crowd ended that story with ropes. What they did with the wreckage is the part usually left out, and it is the part that carries the meaning. They carted the lead north, recast it in Wolcott's orchard, and issued it back to the army. And the very next morning, their commander, who wanted ordered liberty and not a mob, set down in writing the difference between zeal and riot. The statue had been an act of thanks. In 1766, with the hated Stamp Act just repealed, the New York General Assembly voted to honor the king who had relieved them. They commissioned the London sculptor Joseph Wilton, and in 1770 his work was raised on a tall marble pedestal at the foot of Broadway in the park called Bowling Green. The next year, the city ringed the park with an iron fence, in part to guard the king's statue from harm. 2 tons of lead, gilded from the horse's hoof to the rider's brow, caught the harbor light. Wilton gave the king the body of an emperor. The pose copied the most famous equestrian statue in the world, the ancient bronze Marcus Aurelius that still presides over the Capitoline in Rome. George III sat his horse in Roman dress, a Caesar sat down in the harbor of a colonial town. Copying that pose was itself the argument. Authority, the figure said, is old and settled and gilded. It has ridden out of the ancient world and arrived, by descent, at this man, and a subject looking up at it was meant to feel small and grateful and quiet. George III himself, 3,000 miles away, was an earnest and dutiful and stubborn man who believed, as kings believed, that his colonies owed him their obedience. The legend of the mad tyrant came later, and most of it later still. The statue asked New Yorkers for something plainer than love or hatred. It asked them to accept the descent of his authority as the order of nature, the way the tide is the order of nature. That settled question, whether authority comes down to a people or up from them, was the thing on trial in the summer of 1776. The declaration reached New York as a printed sheet. John Dunlap had set it in type in Philadelphia on the night of July 4 and run off perhaps 200 copies before morning. Writers carried them out to the conventions and the army. On July 9, General Washington had the document read to his brigades drawn up on the commons, the open ground that is now City Hall Park, at 6 in the evening. He wanted the men to know why they were about to fight. The reading, one of them recorded, was answered with 3 cheers. Then the crowd went down Broadway. Soldiers, sailors, and, by most accounts, members of the Sons of Liberty threw ropes over the gilded king and hauled until the lead gave way, the figure came off its pedestal, and the head was struck off in the street. the statue of George III was tumbled down and beheaded. A young officer named Samuel Blackley Webb, an aide to Washington, wrote in his journal, adding that the troops had long wished to do it and had seized the publishing of the declaration as a favorable occasion. A lieutenant named Isaac Bangs, watching, expected the lead would soon make deep impressions in the bodies of the king's own soldiers. What happened the next morning is the reason this belongs to the founding, and not merely to a night of high feeling. Washington, who had every reason to welcome the act, refused to bless the manner of it. In his general orders of July 10, he allowed that the men had been moved by zeal in the public cause, and then he checked them. The deed had so much the appearance of riot and want of order that he disapproved it and directed that in future such things be left to be executed by proper authority. The commander of an army fighting for self-government would not let that army govern by mob. The lead was going to the war, and it would go there by order, drawn from the difference between liberty and license that he drew in writing 12 hours after the medal hit the street. The body of the king went to Litchfield because that is where Oliver Wolcott lived, and Wolcott was a man you could trust with a war. He would sign the declaration for Connecticut that fall, once illness let him reach Philadelphia. He commanded militia, he had a yard with room for a fire. Through the late season, his household and his neighbors turned a monument into ammunition. The work was domestic and it was relentless, melt, pour, cool, count. By the household's own count, found among Oliver Wolcott's papers and preserved in the town's history, the women and children of the family made 42,088 cartridges, each one a plain gray answer to a gilded question. The head took a different road. Hacked from the body in the street and meant at first for display on a spike, it was secured by a British officer, Captain John Montresor, and shipped across the ocean to Lord Townsend in England. Thomas Hutchinson, the exiled royal governor of Massachusetts, saw it there as a curiosity in 1777, and after that it disappears from the record. So the two halves of the king parted ways. The head sailed home to be looked at, the body stayed to be fired. Not all of him is accounted for. The statue weighed something near 2 tons, and the lead that became ammunition adds up to about half of that. Somewhere between Bowling Green and the orchard, perhaps in one night in the Connecticut woods, the better part of a ton of the king simply vanished, and treasure hunters have been chasing it ever since. A little survived even the fire. Fragments of the horse turned up at Wilton, Connecticut in 1871 and were bought by the New York Historical Society, where the horse's tail is on display still. And the lead kept its work, a single musket ball recovered from the battlefield at Monmouth, where Washington's army fought in 1778, was matched by its alloy in modern testing to the metal of the statue, a fleck of the king fired, it seems, at the soldiers of the king. The fence is still there. The iron rail New York raised in 1771 around Bowling Green still stands, the oldest fence in the city, and the tops of its posts are still rough where, by long tradition, the royal crowns that once finished them were sawn off during the Revolution. You can put your hand on the marks. They are the record of a decision made by a particular people in a particular July, that authority would rise from their own consent or it would not stand at all. The statue is gone, melted and fired and scattered. The decision is the thing they left standing, and it stands the way the fence stands, in the open, unfinished, and waiting on the hands of whoever comes next. And now, Kim's perspective. Kim's perspective. Independence is a thing a free people keeps choosing or stops having. The men who pulled down George III had grasped the easy half, that a distant power had forfeited their loyalty. Their commander had grasped the harder half, that a people who throw off a king by riot have only traded masters unless they bind themselves, the very next morning, to laws and to an authority of their own making. That is why the Declaration was the work of elected representatives in Congress assembled, and why its central claim still binds us. That governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, and that consent is a standing obligation renewed in every generation. The lead of a king became the defense of a self-governing people because that people did the harder work of governing themselves, and the saw marks on the Bowling Green fence are an assignment handed forward to the living. Hold your elected representatives to the document that empowers them, and the independence cast in that Litchfield orchard stays loaded. Let consent decay into a formality, and you are back under a man on a horse, whatever you choose to call him. This has been a featured essay by Kim Monson Newsroom, published on The Kim Monson Show. For more from this author, visit kimmonson.com.